Trico was dejected. A red horse with bad gameplay had cornered him at a soda fountain today, telling him he wouldn't be getting an Eco remake for Christmas because Santa Claus didn't believe in Team Eco's games or characters. So here he was, 30 feet of distraught eagle on Christmas Eve with teary eyes and an existential crisis. If Santa Claus didn't believe in Eco, then what about he and Arrow? Arrow tried to console him, showing him her S-Club 7 horse blanket and explaining how it was a special gift from Santa Claus before Trico was even born, and how he wouldn't have been so thoughtful if he didn't think anything of them. Trico argued Matter Chris probably bought that blanket for Arrow because she was a golden child horse that always got what she wanted all the time anyways. Trico was clearly upset, and showing her newfound maturity, Arrow wasn't going to argue with him. The only thing she could do was go find a gate to the North Pole that was rumored to be in the vicinity, and explain to the Jolly One himself just what's bothering her brother. And Arrow knew she couldn't just wait for him to come down the chimney, as the podcast studio and her stable didn't have one anyways. Goddamn electric heating, Arrow shook her head. Strangely, as Arrow stepped out of town, her perspective changed to the first person, which it had been before anyways, but the story has to relate to Dragon View anyhow. All across the horizon, various puffs of smoke writhed in the light. These were clearly monsters in search of Santa Claus to get those presents for themselves. While Arrow could simply navigate around them, perhaps their highest congregation served as a clue to the whereabouts of the gate to the North Pole. At the far end of a cliff, where a mysterious glowing blue Triforce symbol was known to rest, Arrow spotted a red horse desperately stomping on it, shouting loudly how she wanted to go to the North Pole for all of the carrots she could eat, to never have to recharge her carrots, in fact. She wanted something that would require every other horse to receive less carrots annually, to make up for her desired glut. Epona was making no progress breaching this gate. This was a Triforce, was it not? This should be her destiny. She scowled as Arrow walked forward, but soon had to avert her gaze as a white light cut the sky in twain, and Arrow was nowhere to be seen. Arrow, you see, had only Trico in her heart as she stepped across the sigil, and when she reached the other side, she was spinning in place to the point of nausea. The large circular teleportation rune beneath her, Santa's whole-ass workshop in front of her. She galloped to Santa and he greeted her. Ho ho ho! Well, if it isn't Arrow the horse. You must be on the nice list to make it through that path of magic. What may I do for you, my equine friend? Santa, Trico doesn't think you will bring him the Eco remake because you don't believe in us. Ho ho ho, Arrow, that's ridiculous. I can't bring him the Eco remake because it doesn't fucking exist. Trico rubbed his eyes. It was the middle of the night, but he could smell fresh brewed candy cane, hot chocolate, and freshly baked gingerbread animals in the kitchen. Arrow, you better not be trying to fool me, but he was gobsmacked when Arrow was eating cookies and drinking hot chocolate with the real, actual Santa Claus in the studio kitchen. And in fact, Santa Claus had an Eco remake peeping out of his swollen bag, because why the hell not? That's what Santa magic is for, I guess.
I think the most impressive thing about this intro is that there were neither dragons nor you viewing them.
No, but I
already, well done, Matt.
I already had a podcast like that like a long time ago, so, you know, I had to subvert some
I don't think that would stop you. It wouldn't stop me, but...
Sure. This is, however, in fact, the podcast for Dragon View. It's their December podcast 2021. But before we get into that, Chris, how was your December?
My December was good, and it being December, happy birthday, Matt.
Thank you.
As for things I've been up to, since I've read all the Hitchhiker Guide series, I decided to take a break from fiction and move on to nonfiction, which is interesting for me, but not too interesting for the podcast, so I'll move on. I'll just do a little quick update on my Spelunky 2 stuff. To keep this vague, even though I could probably just tell you everything off podcast, I have finally made some progress from the last area I was in. So finally, some persistence is paying off. I don't know how far I am from the, I would say, direct path final boss, because Spelunky 2 sure has a lot of new changes and updates.
Right.
But I'm getting some new items that I haven't discovered before, and I'm slowly picking up some things that might lead to other secrets. But for the moment, I'm pretty glad with my progress, so here's to hoping I can see more improvements in the next cast.
I'm not actually sure how far you've made it now. Have you made it past the area the last time I was talking to you about this?
Yeah, I may have made some progress after that that I did not mention on the podcast. I mentioned to you because I forgot
Right.
how Spelunky 2 works. But nevertheless, yeah, I made some progress now, so I am happy. And in time, maybe I will go to other paths if I ever get to this boss, which I assume there is because it's Spelunky. Well, what took up most of my time in December is Heart Machine's new game, Solar Ash. I am just completely super into this game. I've sort of taken a break for now because I blasted through it as quickly as I could. Well, not as quickly as I could, but I definitely did a lot of exploration. I went after all the upgrades. I went through the most difficult playthrough mode. So I just got myself really into it. And it's hard to compare to Hyper Light Drifter, which I absolutely love, because it's totally different game. For one, there is dialogue in this game and text, and it's voiced, so no deciphering here. Of course, there are still sort of things you need to piece together. I just think it's really interesting how Heart Machine took this new approach in a different way, but it still has a lot of the stuff that is, I don't know, it makes Heart Machine like pretty neat for me. So I'm pretty glad to see this completely different entry, but it still have a lot of, as a play on words, the heart that Heart Machine has. I think one of the things I like most about Solar Ash is just the movement in a game is really cool. I don't know if that's really a big thing for most people, but it for some reason is just really appealing to me. I just like boosting and skating along the world. So, I don't know, it's just fun, and I'm trying to work on a speedrun trophy, which is like something that I was kind of working on for a while, and then I got a little too invested in it. So I was like, maybe I should stop trying to do something that's world record worthy and then just try to play at my own pace. I'm not trying to actually go on like speedrun.com, but I just wanted like a really good speed that I'd be happy with. And then I kind of messed up something, and I was like, oh, I don't really like how that turned out. And I kind of took a break, but I wanted to like, get back to it and clear it under 3 hours, which is the trophy. But I think my personal
Oh,
goal is
okay.
2 hours. Yeah.
I thought you meant you had to get a world record to get the get the trophy, get to the
Nah,
top of
you just need to do it
the
under 3 hours, which is totally doable, especially if you're playing on New Game Plus and you get upgrades carried over, which helps a lot. But I'm just really into, I gotta do a really good time for myself. I mean, I've been playing this so much, I must know all the good paths and tricks now. But yeah, I'm working on it. I just really like it, so I really want to do that for myself. Yeah, but it's a neat game, and I think if you like Hyper Light Drifter, it's definitely worth checking out, even if they are different. I'm trying to keep it vague because it is sort of like an artsy short game, so there's like a lot of neat things about it that I don't want to like. I just want people experienced, like for Santa as it flows along. Yeah.
I intend to play it myself at some point, so yeah, that's probably for the best.
But otherwise, that's about it for me. What's going on with you, Matt?
December was pretty good. Holidays were decent. Still quite tired, so I'm sure that will reflect on the podcast. I'll try to get through what I played kind of quickly because there's been a few. I played through Valhalla again this year, but I played this, quote unquote, in real time. Except for like Christmas Day, I had some catching up to do on Boxing Day a few days there, but otherwise I played it day by day, which was an interesting way to play it because I had forgotten a lot of details about the game. And when you're playing it day by day, there's sometimes you want to see what's going to happen immediately next, even though you know that resolution to what you're seeing is maybe a few game days away rather than the next. So I don't know when the next time I'll play this is, but I was glad I didn't replay it immediately last year, and I waited a year to do it and to do it in this format. So that was an interesting experiment for sure.
Did you have a chance to buy more stuff for Jill's room? I remember last time I was talking about how I was so terrible at the minigame shoot 'em up, and you weren't aware of that. It's from buying the game
I
console for
played it a
Jill.
bit. I mean, I had the game console last time, I just never clicked on it, I guess. Yeah, I played a bit of this. I guess because I like shoot 'em up, so I didn't like that one that much because it's whatever. So
Yeah, well.
I think I'd
At
think
least you're
I'd
playing on the
yeah.
Switch, so you don't have an awful trophy haunting you on Steam. Actually, it's an achievement on Steam, but nevertheless, you know that thing, Chivos.
I got a copy of record of Lodoss War, Deedless in Wonder Labyrinth on the Switch, and I started it. I haven't put much time into it yet because, again, I had to pick and choose my battles in terms of what I played over the break, but it's a good game. It's a good Metroidvania. I was just going to get it digitally, but then I noticed some of the outlets were having the physical version, which came with a few things, a CD and a little art book and stuff like that. So it's funny, I got so excited for this game, even though my record of Lodoss War experience is extremely minimal. Like, back on peer-to-peer sharing, back when that was when that was coming out kind of stuff, like sketchy-ass things like that experience, but still, it looked like a really good game. I started watching a review of it a few months ago, and I was like, no, you know what, I'm gonna play this game, so I gotta hang up this review and just do that. It's been on Steam for a while, it just came out on consoles, so I'll probably get to that next month, or through the end of this month. And PlayStation 2, since my brother got home, and we got home in the safest way that we could, so all that should be copacetic. We played through Over the Hedge on PS2, which is another movie from his childhood, and we were expecting something like really awful, but it was actually kind of good. So I was surprised. I was almost disappointed it wasn't terrible. And it's not like an amazing game, but for a licensed game for kids, like, it had a lot of things to collect and find, and you know, it's a sequel to the movie, because they didn't do well enough to get a real sequel, like Madagascar did, I guess. So it was surprisingly good. It was like Marvel Ultimate Alliance meets Metal Gear Solid 3. Lots of stealth and lots of beat-em-up stuff. I don't have a second working PS2 controller, so I think this game might have had actual two-player. We did Relay two-player. But you have two characters at all times, so I think we missed out by not having a second PS2 controller on the go, so I might have to rectify that
next Christmas. Yeah.
I'll see what I get next Christmas. Maybe it'll be the fucking Shark Tale game or something. Something
the,
really awful.
The bear or whatever was watching in the game.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, that was one of the plot. I had to find a satellite dish because they were tired of watching Shark Tale, I guess. So I'm thinking, I've never seen the fucking movie and I'm already tired of it. So anyways, that was a fun diversion. It actually took us like a week or a week and a half of playing the game to get through it, because it's actually kind of long and there's actually a lot to do. So yeah, Over the Hedge on PS2. Good game, I guess. who would have known? Who would have known?
When do we expect your write-up on your website?
Oh, I won't do that, but the only other game I played, and it's been the one I've been playing mostly this week pretty intently, was Breath of the Wild. I'm finally playing after, you know, almost 5 years later now. I'm enjoying it a lot more than I thought it was. Because, not because of my hang-ups with the Zelda series, but more because of my hang-ups with open-world games. I get exhausted with them really quickly. But I find that the overworld in Breath of the Wild isn't really having that effect on me. Because while it's very dense and there's a lot to do, it's not as hand-holdy and directed as, say, The Witcher or Ghost of Tsushima were. And it's a really nice overworld. It does a lot of nice things with light, and some of the areas are interesting. Like, you'll find bridges and towns named after past things. Like, the I find it funny that the Lynels get such a glow-up in this game, but then Gleok gets a fucking wooden bridge in a duck pond. Like, some old, like, Gleok bridge, and it's just, like, shitty old wooden bridge over a fucking duck pond. I'm like, okay, sure, Gleok bridge. I've arrived. But yeah, it's been fun. Like, I even like the weapon durability thing, because it has me changing weapons a lot. So it just keeps mixing it up. And I kind of like the Sheikah Slate stuff. You get all of your real puzzle-solving elements really close to the beginning of the game. And they're all fairly natural to use and have lots of different applications. I've only done one Divine Beast, Favruta, the elephant, and that whole sequence was pretty good. It was a small dungeon, but it used a lot of what I had picked up exploring the world. So yeah, it was fine. I know that the dungeons and the actual bosses of the game are quite limited. I found like the one story boss I've done in that Divine Beast, like way easier than the Lynels I fought on the overworld. So it's like the actual story bosses are pretty manageable and easy, but some of the things you'll run into on the overworld, you can get out of depth really quick, which I appreciated. So I'm, I go into some place I really shouldn't be, and they're doing 4 to 5 hearts of damage to you all of a sudden. So I do like that. I think it gets mitigated as you get gear, of course. But yeah, I've just enjoyed exploring it and getting out of depth and seeing what kind of trouble I can get into. And I think now that I've explored a lot of the world, the game will start finishing quickly. Well, not finishing quickly, but like I'll have the capacity to finish it much more quickly. I think you can run to the end right from the beginning anyways, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I still need to play the game for myself fully instead of just messing around for like an hour or two. My favorite moment was dying in the River of the Dead, which was very expected, but I appreciated actually dying in a Zelda game. Haven't done that in a very long time.
See, I think what's happened here is that because there is auto saves and a lot of checkpoints, that Nintendo has decided that, okay, enemies can actually do damage this time. So, because you're not really losing a lot of progress when you die in this game, and I've died plenty of times in this game because I'm taking out a lot of enemies when I should just walk past them and I'm going out of depth and all that. You're usually not really set back very far, which some people would say is taking away some of the difficulty, but by the same token, it allows the enemies to do 5 or 6 hearts of damage to you with a swing, depending on what weapons they have and the tier of monster that they are. So, yeah, I think doing it that way has actually allowed the game to have some teeth. And again, like us talking about the Lynels, they're a lot more like a Souls enemy than a Zelda enemy. No, not to compare things to Souls, but it's all about like parrying, right? So it kind of went that direction. I thought they're pretty neat.
Since you brought up the Souls comparison, who are the cool characters in this game?
And like, there's a lot of interesting characters. I just met a dude. I haven't found him again, but he loves monsters, so he's under my kindred spirits. There's a lot of decent characters. I like most of the Sheikah you meet. Paya, Pura, and Dr. Robbie are all fairly endearing. A lot of the townsfolk that give you various side quests, like the young boy in Hattino who wants to see all of these weapons that his grandfather's told him about, and there's a lot of characters like that are just kind of endearing among the general populace. And Prince Sidon is a very positive and likable character, even beyond the memes. One of the champions from the Pastra Valley is basically just Falco. And he's a dickhead, but I kind of like him.
I've looked up these characters in the past too, and I've said, I think I'd probably like Revali. And my friends tell me, he's pretty much just Falco. Well, who is my favorite Star Fox character? So I know there's also a bird with an accordion named Cass or something,
Oh,
and I'm like, oh.
Cass is really cool. Cass is really cool because you find him out in the wild, and he sings songs about the shrines in the area, gives you hints in how to find them. So that's cool. Yeah, there's some interesting characters in there for sure.
The other important question is, have you gotten the Tingle outfit?
I have not. I don't know if it's on the set of islands named after Tingle and his brothers, but those islands are really high and really highly guarded, so I haven't tried to breach them yet. Because it looks like it's going to be a bit of an adventure in and of itself. So.
Oh, someday. I'm so excited for when you get the Tingle outfit.
I don't know if
That's
that's
very
a
important.
DLC thing or if it's like in the game
Oh.
already,
That would be a shame
because,
if it was. Damn.
well, there is like a DLC.
Very Tingle Wind Waker if it was DLC, so.
I'd love it to be in the game as it is. Like, anyhow, I think I've talked a bit much about Breath of the Wild. I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying it. I'm not a complete curmudgeon about everything Zelda, as it turns out. So that's good. Dragon View was developed by Kotobuki System and published by Kemco in 1994 for the SNES. It is otherwise known as Dragon 2 or Super Dragon, and is a sequel to that title. While Dragon View maintains the first-person overworld exploration aspect of Dragon, the combat and interior sections are now a much different beat-em-up style action RPG. Sort of a fusion there. That said, do you have any experience with Dragon View or Dragon?
This is going to be my 5-second part in the cast because I have zero experience with Dragon and Super Dragon, or Dragon View. I guess I should state that I'll probably call it Super Dragon because I think that is a way cooler name than Dragon View, to be quite honest, but it's fine.
So I do have some experience with Dragon, mostly the SNES version. And not really a childhood game for me. I picked it up when I started collecting SNES games, and it's really kind of a different style game. Like, Dragon has this sort of automated battle system, and there's some tactical input you can do with it. Like, it's really difficult to describe the battle system of Dragon without having you play it as well. But you gear up and get spells for your party, and they will play out the battles when you arrive in them. And Dragon was a favorite game of, like, I wouldn't say favorite game, but it's a game I really enjoyed because of how trance-like it can be. Like, the music and the setting of the original Dragon are quite trance-like and quite abstract at times. It's a very interesting game, especially to play late at night. And we'll have to delve into it at some point, or you'll have to delve into it at some point, because it's a polarizing experience, but it's an interesting one. So, Dragon View was a game I think I knew of before Dragon, and I think I may have seen it in Nintendo Power or another magazine. And so Dragon View was always a name that was always on my mind. But when I learned that it was Super Dragon, like, all bets were off. I had to have it at that point. So it's been, oh geez, I don't know if it's 10 years yet since I played this game, but it's been a while. And yeah, I found out it was Super Dragon and I had to have it. That's basically it. So in general, I kind of talked about this being a fusion of a couple different styles, but in general, how does the game play out?
So the game is displayed as the top half is where all the action happens. You're playing as Alex, and you walk around town, you talk to people, kind of like other action games of the time. And then when you go into battle on the overworld, it kind of goes into this own section where, just like an action game, you would just have your inputs like swinging the sword, and then if you had a sort of magic spell on the other button, you would use that. The lower half of the screen is similar to what point-and-click games would look like, where all your stats and information are listed down there. So pretty much all the action is taking effect into the upper half, which I think makes it look like the Super Nintendo has a lot of processing power because it's all focused there, so I think that's neat.
Yeah. And speaking of processing power and Dragon, and Super Dragon as well, I think, I don't think it has any kind of hardware acceleration to do the pseudo 3D. I think I was reading something about that today. Is this how they've set up the screen? They can do this with it, like a Super FX chip or anything like that. So
yeah, that isn't Mode 7 or anything, is it?
Yeah, there might be some. I think there's some sprite scaling or what have you in it, but at the very least, I don't think it requires any kind of special chip. So while the overworld sections of Dragon and Super Dragon, Dragon View, are quite rudimentary, they're actually kind of impressive in that regard. And there's something about this flat-shaded overworld that really appeals to me somehow. It provides its own challenges in terms of finding things or navigating around monsters which appear as puffs of smoke on the overworld. More so than the action RPG sections, Like the actual overworld stuff kind of defines these games or sets them apart. It's that kind of perspective is what will grab people first and makes them a little bit more interesting. Anyhow, that's getting a bit final thoughty, right? So
I like how enemies are displayed on the overworld map. I would definitely prefer that over random invisible battles. So I think that was a good choice for Super Draken.
So that's basically how it plays out. I think we will talk more about the overworld when we get into the discussion of the game, which is what we're going to get into. So I'm going to keep this semi-loose. We're going to go through mostly the main dungeons and some quests that we feel are important. You can feel free to interject if something comes up that you need to talk about.
Of course.
Dragon View, I guess it's got a linear path to it, but there's a lot of off-road you can do in it to find things that can help you along your way or find NPCs or special areas that have upgrades. So we're not going to talk about them exhaustively, but I do want to talk about the overworld in a bit. Before we get to there, I guess we should talk about the opening. So let's talk about the opening scenes of Dragon View when Katarina gets, like, your hometown gets attacked and your girlfriend Katarina gets taken, right?
Yeah,
and I don't know if they mentioned the gate to the underworld now, but it's a prevalent focus throughout the game. This wizard, Giza, is attempting to find the gate to the underworld, and he needs Katarina in order to open it. And he bodies the hell out of Alex anytime that they encounter one another. So that's sort of the opening to Dragon View. We want to rescue Katarina. We want to put an end to the schemes of Giza. And we're going to trudge through this land to do it.
I think it's also worth mentioning that during the opening scene, you had given Katarina a necklace. And then when she was kidnapped, it was dropped. And it was brought up that this necklace is very important. So that will come relevant much later in the game.
So let's talk about the overworld. We're going to get to the first dungeon pretty soon. The first proper dungeon. But the overworld, how does it change as you walk across the overworld? And this is talking more about the central mass rather than this little partition for Hoogia. How does the overworld change as you walk across it?
It definitely took me a really long time to understand the map and the overworld system in this game. One issue is that I'm just really bad with estimating distance when you travel across it, and it gets even worse when you start filling out more sections of the map. But otherwise, getting used to walking around the overworld is okay. I have a lot of trouble entering things because there's no sort of shift button like there is in other games. I guess when I was first playing this, my first thing I went to is games with more of a constricted box system when you're exploring in first person, like Etrian Odyssey or Shin Megami Tensei. Right. And you can always use like the shoulder buttons to kind of shift yourself over to go into entrances. In this one, because you're sort of loosely on the overworld, I don't know how they really calculated this, but you need to enter entrances like at a right angle or else you just bump into trees or you just don't go anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, most of the entrances that you find have those trees or rocks in them for you to line yourself up with it. And you don't have to be lined up perfectly. Sometimes you can go in on a bit of an angle. Of a
weird angle, yeah.
That depends on what the topography is at that particular place. It takes a little bit of getting used to. There's not that many landmarks on the map that can really guide you. The biggest thing are if you have roads. They're the biggest thing that can help you.
Yeah, throughout the game, because I love role navigating because there aren't many landmarks like you said, Following along a rock wall usually helps, especially if I don't remember where the turns are, or the roads are probably the biggest thing. Sometimes I'd have to note, like, in between these two trees, that's where I last saw this thing, especially because there are lots of secrets in this game that are, I think, pretty well hidden, and a lot of neat stuff can be gotten from them, but a lot of neat stuff can be received from them, but it's just hard to remember where things are because it's no fault of the game because I don't know how much power or how much graphical qualities they would have had to make things more interesting in the first perspective. But it's really hard to tell what all these trees look like when they all look the same after a while, especially the desert, which we'll get to, is so frustrating to navigate.
So, what things can you find out there? You mentioned there's some, ill-gotten gains to get. What actually can you get there?
So a couple of things that are hidden within secrets. Sometimes they're hidden like this tree with an entrance in it. Sometimes they're just easily cavern along the wall. You'll see these triforces on the ground that were mentioned in the introduction story that you won't be able to access so much later. And then these like compass-looking things which will activate as warps. By the way, it's really important to step on these things sometimes because you might have to walk back a long way later because they're not activated. But in most of these secrets, you can get hearts to increase your HP capacity or stars that will do your MP. And then sometimes you'll get upgrades for your weapon or upgrades for the rings you'll get later on in the game.
There's a lot of good stuff to be found by exploring Dragonview, and I find that sometimes there's a bit of a jump in enemy potency. But if you are exploring and finding like this gear, especially like you can get special techniques for the sword and the Hausa and all of that, but they help immensely. Thing I expected to find the most stuff but didn't was actually jade, which is the currency. I think I'll address this now. Did you find jade to be an issue in this game or no?
At the beginning of the game, yes, and then I started grinding a lot more and it started building up. Or maybe I just got really fortunate because in some random battles, if you defeat an enemy, it'll explode a lot of jade instead of like 50 you get normally. So that helped out a lot.
Get five normally.
Yeah.
But I'm bringing this up because I find even later in the game, some of these chests you'll find will be like 200 jade, and I'm like, that's not even enough for a potion at this point. Because one thing the game does that's a little bit strange is every town that you come to, the price of every item is increased by 100 jade, and there's really, for most of the game, there's no way to keep up with that unless you're actually actively grinding for jade.
Also, in every town, there's a dude, a really shady merchant, who will give you an upgrade to HP capacity, and he always upgrades it after every single one. What is the story with that guy? What's the lore? Why does he have these HP capacity upgrades on him? Who did he kill for these?
I'm not sure, but he disappears and you never find out anyway, so.
Draken 3.
Yeah, well, maybe we're doing the podcast, we'll get a Draken 3. And I will be, for one, probably the only person super thrilled about it, but, I found jade a bit weird. I had loads of it at the end because I bought everything I wanted. But anyways.
Yeah, same.
Yeah. We talked about navigation. It's sometimes a bit tricky to navigate, but in terms of navigating, did you ever find yourself out of depth in the game?
Mentioning earlier, I have a lot of trouble estimating distance, especially when you have the full map in end game, and I found out there's a lot of places to travel to that I just missed out on. It just takes so long to get anywhere, especially if you have the warp, and even if you have the warp, it takes places to get to there because sometimes they're not really marked on the map well enough. It's really cool that it's a really big map. It's just really difficult to actually find things, but I guess that's what game FAQs was for. Thank you. Game FAQs for those last upgrades I want to get after.
When I mentioned out of depth, I was wondering if you ever found yourself against enemies that were way too strong for your current level.
Oh yeah, so that also happened as well. So this happened early on, and then I tried to grind a bit more to avoid that, but that happens sometimes anyway.
Well, the one thing that the game does transitioning into these areas is that the like this palette and the sky will change and the music will change. you know when you're going out of depth, but by the same token, you think, oh, well, I can explore and get around these enemies and find some cool stuff here, too.
Oh, yeah, I guess we should mention one of the rough things about this game is that you can't escape battles once you're locked in them.
Oh, no, you can't. No.
So definitely save often.
Yeah, you cannot escape battles. Like, it's different in the in dungeons. Sometimes you can walk out the door, but the overworld battles, you're locked into them, which I find extremely surprising because I'm 99% sure you can run from battles in Draken, and that game is a lot more punishing than Dragonview. Getting to the first quest in dungeon, I believe in Hoogia, you talk to Tylon, who is the bomb craftsman. And you need to get some bombs to blow through some obstructions at Gallus Pass so you can get the main area of the game and get to the town of Khazdra, I believe. So, Tylon needs dynamite, and that's in the storehouse. How do dungeons generally operate in Dragonview?
So dungeons are set up in... I guess they're all on the same level for the most part. Then they start getting into, like, at least at most, like, three levels in... later in the game, but it's kind of labyrinthine because you'll go through a door and it leads to somewhere else, but that's also, I guess, something that's a bit difficult with the perspective of how it connects. For most of the game, it's kind of straightforward, but it can be a little labyrinthine from just traveling from these different doors and entrances, and especially when you get into later dungeons when you can fall through the floor, then that adds another layer to it because you'll need to figure out how to get back upstairs or... There'll be more puzzles on navigation later in the game that we'll talk about.
Can you get the Hauza from the armory before you come here, or is it only afterwards?
I don't recall. I think I got it beforehand. I happened to pick it up. Yeah. But I guess I'll review now that I actually didn't use that Hauza as much. I found it very situational.
No?
But I did find it very useful at a certain part in the game. I just preferred using the sword for most of the game. It just worked out for me that way.
Well, so the Hauza is sort of like this throwing blade. I use the Hauza mostly, just because of the distance of it. There are certain things that you can only hit with the sword, like the scorpion enemies. The Hauza goes above them, so you can't actually hit them with it. But I found the Hauza technique, like the special powered-up throw, like way more effective than the sword one, because it pierces through enemies and can kill multiple. So towards the end of the game, you know, I'd get to the side of the entire group of enemies and just chuck the Hauza through them and clean house, but towards the beginning, you're definitely switching between them a lot more. Or at least I was switching between them a lot more. I think for Pyrrhus, you probably want to use a sword, though, because he's kind of low to the ground. And this is a giant scorpion. What do you think of this boss?
I think it was a good introduction to the game. I think the flow of it really is that you strike it once if you are not super overleveled, which I was not yet, but... Yeah, you kind of strike it once, and then you just quickly move it out of the way as it does a charge. And then if you have like enough time, you can strike it while its back is turned before you can do another back and forth of just striking it before it moves. I didn't actually see it in this encounter because the AI was strange, but in a surprise, Pyrrhus comes back again. It can pierce you with its tail because it's a scorpion. I don't know why it didn't happen in the first boss battle, but that is a thing it can do. And it's kind of quick, actually, so... Fortunately, there are no status effects in this game, so it's not like poison would be an issue.
I guess you were hitting it enough that it was only counterattacking, and it never really got to use its regular attack. Like, Pyrrhus is a fairly simple monster, so it's easy to get it stuck in that kind of loop. There's other bosses have the charge as well, but they have a lot more mix-ups, like the next boss especially.
Yeah, maybe it was just the rhythm I had found, just got it stuck in that AI loop.
So we bring this dynamite to Tylon, and we get some bombs. Now, we're going to go over Gallus Pass. They recommend grinding fruit from Gallus Pass to sell for jade, but it's like one jade per fruit, and you can only carry 99 of them. Well, you might be able to carry less than that unless you had the big bag. I don't remember. Like, I got the big bag, and I could carry 99, so that's probably the upper limit of it anyways.
I don't recall because I didn't bother collecting fruit until I ran into a dude later on in the game. He said, I will trade you 50 fruit for a heart upgrade or something. I was like, grab, where am I going to get fruit from?
Yeah, so grinding fruit, you may want to grab some if every time you come through here, because you'll be through here a couple of times in the very near future, so you may as well get it while you're coming through, but...
I didn't think about it then, Matt. Maybe I should have.
Where main goal here is the town of Khazra. Now, it has a grave that's important. It's a grave of a sister who was... She was cursed with an illness, and this gets explained a lot more later, because this is Giza's sister, and she died, and...
What a surprise.
Yeah. Well, I don't think her ghost appears yet until later, but, like, she died, and so he blames the gods, and that's why he's trying to breach the underworld, because it's one of these things where he needs to have power himself rather than rely on the power of deities, I guess. The main thing...
I want to say that mystery was really poorly done, because I think right before you get to Khazra, you get one of those change in perspectives where you see what Giza's up to, and you find out, like, his demon knight is really pissed off that he's taking orders from a human. Why does he have to take orders from a human? And then you get to Khazra, and then you get to the grave, and some lady tells you this backstory about, oh, yes, there was a brother who really loved his sister, and his sister died, so I wonder what happened to him. And I'm like, truly a mystery, considering the cutscene I just saw.
Well, the people in this world will know it's Giza.
Well, I know, but for the player, I think that little reveal that Giza's human was, I don't know, maybe they could save that for later.
The main information we get here is that Kaer Temple, which we know from, like, these scenes, that this is where Giza has taken Katarina. But Kaer Temple is under siege by Giza. This is also where the Prime Orb is. However, it's locked behind a fortress of ice. You need to find a way to melt your way in. So, you have to go back to your hometown to get some scales from your mentor. And the scales are sort of a limited projectile that can extinguish fires. And we need these because Rodister, which is a sage in a cave that we find, tells us about the Ring of Fire and the fire cave that we have to go through to get it. So, that's a long-winded way to bring us to this first question. What kind of challenges await you in this fire cave?
Yeah, that was a long-winded way to say that we have to backtrack and then go back again. But
yeah.
So, seeing that the scales were a limited resource, I thought that'd be more of a concern. But fortunately, when you go into the fire cave, there's only, like, a couple of fire pillars that you would need to address. So, in the end, you'd probably, like, use 10 of them. So, it's actually not as big deal as I thought it would be. I never thought about using them against enemies. Maybe that's what the game expected you to do. But I think I had decently grinded, so I didn't find the fire cave as difficult as it was probably supposed to be. I just don't really recall it that well, because I don't remember any much. I don't remember having issues with it.
I hadn't grinded to this point, so I got to the boss and I got killed. But I was trying to use the scales on him and I wasn't really doing frig all, so...
We'll have a trade-off, Matt, don't worry.
Sure. One thing I'll mention about the fire cave is that there's now more environmental things going on here. There's, one-way doors and pitfalls to drop down and fire waves to jump over and all that. It steps up the environmental pressure, I think. And while the music is more intense than the fire cave actually is, it's a pretty nice dungeon, I thought. I thought it was a definite step up from the storehouse. So, yeah, I liked it.
Yeah, I agree. It was okay, yeah.
Yeah, it was okay. But like you said, if you had been grinding at this point, like, this is one of these games that, like a lot of RPGs from the time, levels do make a difference and upgrades do make a difference. So, again, like, towards the end of the game, I was just blasting through shit because of the level 2 Hausa technique, but right now, you're a bit more at the mercy. And you don't want to use your potions because they're so friggin' expensive at this point, but, you know.
Yeah, and the special technique, I think, uses, I don't want to say, like, 4 hearts off your bar. It's, like, equivalent to, like, a chunk off your HP at this point, so I was pretty conservative about using the special technique.
I don't know if I've found any by now. Again, like, that's up to your exploration route, whether you found that stuff or not. Now, the second boss, the Efreet, Tell us about this boss.
Matt, I wish I could tell you because I breezed through this dungeon, but I guess it's different than Pyrsa because it's sort of like a... I guess it's formed like a gas giant. Like, it kind of, I guess, has sort of that typical genie look to it.
Right.
Except it's all fire. But I unfortunately don't remember much of his attacks, so Matt, you'll have to relate from here.
Well, I mean, he does the same charging thing that Pyrsa does when you hit him, but he also has, like, projectiles from across the room. And some of them come in waves and such. And like I said, I hadn't grinded, so I did get killed by him close to the end of finishing him. So I think jumping over the waves of fire has a little bit of a weird hitbox, and that's probably what got me. So the next time I came in like two levels higher, and he was nothing at that point. But
it's amazing how two levels make a difference in this game.
You fight this guy like five or six more times in the game. Pyrsa has repeated two or three more times, but this guy gets repeated a lot. And when you fight him again, and when you fight Pyrsa again, they're not that much stronger. So you do blow through them pretty quick then, but yeah, this guy gave me a bit of trouble the first time. Now, this is potentially your first magic ring. I'm not sure if you can get the thunder ring before this, but if you know where it is, maybe you can. This is the fire ring. Talk about magic in this game, and talk about the fire ring.
So magic is displayed as a set of stars on the lower end of the screen. And I don't recall how much the fire ring uses because I actually didn't use magic that much at this part of the game because it's so limited. And I don't think you have much use for it right now. You will very soon though. But otherwise, yeah, you just equip it to one of the other buttons on your Super Nintendo controller and that will fire off a projectile.
Yeah, so it's a fairly valuable resource now when you don't have many stars, but it's useful to have some spells on hand. But for the most part, magic is mostly used to interact with dungeon obstacles in this game, particularly the fire ring for the next one, of course. Returning to Khazdra, there was a house with some monks in it, and now they will let you take a teleporter to the snow fields outside of where the Kyr Temple is, but there's, as we said, an ice fortress in the way. The snow field is kind of nice. It has more dragon-y music than the game has had so far. Not really dragon-style music, but it's getting there. The enemies here, of course, are a bit tougher and all that, but they're not too bad. This is probably also the first time you'll meet a roaming healer, which will heal you for 50 jade, which is a bit harsh to pay that much at this point, depending on what you've been buying. But I kind of get a kick out of it. If you don't want to pay that, you can say that you're going to suffer.
Yeah.
Now, of course, there's a few things to find in the snowfield, but the main point of interest is the fortress. Talk about the ice fortress.
Yes, this is where your fire ring will come in handy. So in the ice fortress, I think the main thing that you'll be using your fire ring for is that there are these pillars of ice that block holes or just ways to navigate the dungeon, so you'll be using that. Fortunately, you only need to use like one projectile to make your way through. But otherwise, I think it's definitely a step up from the fire dungeon, just in terms of navigating it. And I think it looked cooler, but it is ice, so what can I say?
Does this dungeon introduce the gargoyles?
I don't recall, but those enemies are assholes.
Because they laugh at you? They're pretty cute. Yeah, I like the layout of this dungeon. Like, there's some floors that have, they're icy floors, so you slide on them, but then the walls are lined with spikes. So I thought that was kind of cute, and one thing I mentioned about this, I went through this dungeon like twice because I was going to leave it, and then I noticed a magic container behind a wall or something, and there was one path I didn't take, and I can't believe I missed it at the time, but I scoured that entire dungeon, like top to bottom, trying to get that friggin' MP container, so that was an adventure and a half there.
Yeah. I don't know when this starts becoming relevant in the dungeons, but sometimes dungeons back entrances get really discreet, so that's kind of fun to find. Especially, I guess, exploration out in the overworld, they get really discreet at hiding secrets from, like, in the background or on the sides.
That was a fun dungeon to get through. Like, there's a lot of verticality in it and a lot of jumping down holes. But let's talk about the Ice Demon, because the Ice Demon, unlike the previous two bosses, this is the only time you fight it, as far as I remember. Unless I missed one.
I think, yeah, this is the only time it shows up in the game.
Yeah, so talk about this Ice Demon.
Yeah, so the Ice Demon has two phases. The first phase is kind of like a tree, I guess. I don't know how you describe it. But during this phase, it's best to use the fire ring to completely wear it down. Mm-hmm. And then in the second phase, the eye of the tree is going to be separated from it.
Yeah.
So while the tree is charging, the eye can somewhat like projectiles at you, but you're supposed to be hitting the eye to damage it.
Yeah, I don't know if it's just because I was low on upgrades here, but this took me a long time to kill that eye.
I was going to mention, this is my trade-off, because I got to this boss, and I used the fire ring to go through phase one extremely quickly, and then I got to the eye, and my sword is doing barely any damage. So I figure, oh, maybe this is just more use of the fire ring, and I used one of those crystals that you can use to replenish MP.
Yeah.
That was not the answer. It turns out I needed to let myself die and then level up a few more so I could actually do sufficient damage to the eye.
Oh, so it was just a matter of leveling up. I whittled it down. I think I had to quaff a potion in the meanwhile because, you know, the longer you take at something, the more damage you're going to take. But
well, I thought when I was you're at a low death level, it takes a minuscule damage, so yeah. I figured I need to level up for this.
Well, I figured I must be doing something wrong, which is what I was going to think, you know, maybe Chris found something different to do against it because I was doing damage and I figured, well, I can wear it down and kill it, but it took a long time.
Yeah, fortunately it's not too difficult to dodge the stuff in phase two, but at the damage I was doing against it, I was like, I'm doing something wrong here, I'll probably just level up. And then that's when I realized how the game really screws you over if you're not leveled up sufficiently.
Well, I wonder if the sword technique would be good against it, but the sword technique drains your life.
So. Yeah, so
I guess that's a trade-off. However, once we destroy the Ice Demon, getting back towards the entrance of the Ice Fortress, we can now access a teleporter. So it's convenient that it's right near the entrance, so if you're backtracking, it's easy to go make a straight line through it. This will take us to the northern snowfields, which is where the Kyr Temple is. And I don't think there's a lot to see in this little section. I think it's mostly just the Kyr Temple.
Yeah, the first two rooms, there's not much to say because, as the monks are saying, as you walk in, you're being attacked. But I guess the giveaway that you're being attacked is that there's a lizard in the first room.
Yeah. It's mostly just a lore dump, this place, to talk about the, I think they talk about elements from Draken, about the eight dragon lords, but mostly to introduce more of what Giza wants to do. He's trying to get the Prime Orb. He beats the absolute shit out of you here. I kind of wish you could control these fights a little bit, but yeah, it's mostly just automated torture porn because he absolutely demolishes you. So
considering how much I got beaten up by the Ice Demon, I'm surprised they also didn't let you bother trying to fight Giza and then do absolutely zero damage against him for like a bit. So I don't know why you're just dragged to a cutscene immediately.
Can you imagine not taking a left when you enter the temple and saving, and if you didn't go back to save after the Ice Demon, and you have to do that whole dungeon. Have to do that whole dungeon again if you got killed on the way up. But yeah, it's mostly just, again, a lore dump. I think they find the underworld gate by the end of it, and that's why Giza doesn't finish you off. He has to divert his attention to the gate or something like that.
Yeah, the demon eye like pops and going, "Hey, we found the demon gate." And
yeah. But you can interact now with records of the past in Kyr Temple, and there's a scientist priest there, like Methraton or something his name is.
Something like that.
He tells you to seek the town of Mirage and the Temple of Orta in the desert. In Mirage, he says to talk to the head sorceress Yuna, So let's head to the desert. You said you want to talk about the desert?
Yeah, it's pretty big. It doesn't have a lot of landmarks, even though it has a ton of secrets, and I find it impossible to navigate there.
Did I maybe miss a map there? I feel like I should have had another map at the desert, and I might not have.
I'm not sure. There's the map near Mirage. I think there's a second one later in the game, but I
Yeah.
feel like there's also some parts in the game, especially in your end game, that they just don't give you maps for some reason.
Well, so we're in the desert. It's big. There's lots of scorpions. There's some sandworms. We go to this quicksand cave and we can't progress it because there's quicksand. This NPC tells us about a golden sandworm that swallowed a horn that we need to get. Talk about this quest for the horn.
First of all, I had to admit to looking this up because I had no idea where to even begin looking for this thing because I assumed, okay, maybe it's in random battles. And then I guess the RNG just wanted to be really mean to me because I just did not have any worm encounters whatsoever. So that took me a while. And then I finally looked it up and, like, oh, you eventually get it from some golden sandworm. I think mostly in this one area. So I went there and I got it like first turn. I was like, geez, thanks, guides. I think the concept is cool, but I think the directions need to be a little less vague just to give you a better idea of where to find this golden sandworm.
I think when you're talking about the scale of the map and distance, this is what comes into play here because I was trying to stay in the northern section of the desert, but I was moving too far south, I think, as I was walking around.
I feel like when I found it, I wasn't even that north to begin with. I was only like slightly north from the quicksand cave, so it's like whatever.
You find it eventually. I do appreciate that it's a different kind of quest for this key item. The horn, then, if you take it back to the quicksand cave and play it near the lion statues, they do a jank-ass Salem from Sabrina mouth thing.
Oh, heck yeah, they do. It's a nice little tune, all right?
and they allow you to pass through the cave. That horn also dissipates lion statues in the desert, and we'll get to that in a bit. But we get to the Town of Mirage. There's a small dungeon in Mirage, I think, to get a musical score for this horn.
Yeah, you kind of go down one staircase in a building and it leads you back to another, but I
Yeah.
think that was just to get the musical score for the horn and prove your worth or
Yeah, it's
something.
just a minor trial. I don't think it was anything too involved.
Yeah.
You can use that horn now back out in the desert to find the mirror under one of those lines. I could talk about the mirror briefly before we move on to the Temple of Orta.
So the mirror has two functions. One, it supposedly reflects enemy attacks, like projectiles, which I never figured out how to use because I just never used it. And also, I don't know timing in this game, I guess. Whatever. Does it reflect them or it just protects you for a bit? I don't know.
Okay.
Anyway, the predominant thing I use the mirror for is when you're at those Triforces, if you use the mirror, it will teleport you to a secret area where you might get HP upgrade or whatever else.
Yeah, you use them at those Triforces to take you somewhere else and get some upgrades. So, about the reflecting attacks, that's a bad choice of words. It does make a barrier around you. When you use the mirror, it creates a barrier around you for 3 stars, I think, and it completely insulates you from an attack. So, fighting bosses later in the game or fighting tough enemies later in the game, it's much more useful than using a couple of magic spells, like even charged up magic spells, for the most part.
Did I make up that reflecting thing, or does someone in the game say that, and I just completely, it's a bad translation or something?
I'm not certain, but yeah.
Okay.
Anyways, it is a very useful item, especially against the last boss.
I
So,
wish I knew that then. Okay,
yeah.
well, good job, me.
So, how do we find the Temple of Orta?
This is something I also had trouble with and had to look up, but apparently it says if you exit Quicksand Cave, just a few steps out of it, you play the horn, and then a flash of light will appear and it will present to you a new path that takes you directly to the temple.
Yeah.
I guess the first few times, it says step on the star, but I guess I stepped on it and it was a bit like too many pixels away from it, and it didn't work, so nevertheless, that's
It
what the
didn't
function
really
is.
work for me the first time I tried this either, but I think I think I walked to the entrance of the quicksand cave, turned around, and tried to do it. I think I'd enter the cave and exit. So the dungeon, the Temple of Orta, it's a relatively straightforward in terms of traps. It's mostly one-way doors and quicksands. Do you have any comments about it?
Not really. I don't think quicksand is actually as bad as it sounds. I mean, you just go to the lower level and you might have to repeat stuff, but
you can usually hop over it, yeah.
It doesn't kill you or anything. Yeah, and
no.
For the most part, you can just, like, jump over it, yeah.
Yeah. I don't really remember this jester boss that much. I just wrote down in that easy jester boss because I don't think it got to do anything to me.
I just wrote a note like, why is the clown in the pyramid temple? Why was this decision? It's such a jarring choice, I guess, for a boss for the pyramid desert temple. I just don't get it, but okay. Could have been a cool lion boss or something. So
could have been a cool lion boss. But at this point in the game, you should have a lot of upgrades, and I don't think it goes down very without much effort, right? It's just
yeah.
So you meet some of the dragon lords at the end of this, and the pendant is revealed to be, I think it's called the Gerdrak at this point.
Something like that, yeah.
And these guys, they direct you to the swamp.
I believe they bring up something about how there's 8 of them, but the other 4 need to be summoned, and they are at the other temple, which, as you mentioned, is in the swamp area.
Sectra Temple, yeah. So I'm going to talk for a few minutes, I guess, because there's a lot that happens, I guess. We're going to the swamp now, and the jade mine is attached to that. You learn in Orisort, which is the village in the swamp, that there's an evil voice that has been spooking the miners and preventing them from making their way into the jade mine. There's a young lady in the village, and her fiancé has gone missing in this mine. And we learn from a scientist here that there's a machine to create a bridge of light to Sectra Temple hidden in this mine. So, we're going to the Jade Mine. The mine's main gimmick is the necessity to use bombs to blow through floors and drop through the right spots. While there are several chests with single bombs along the way, how do you feel about a dungeon that uses a consumable item where jade is generally pretty scarce for most of the early half of the game, with prices in later areas drastically higher than early areas, and a general lack of necessity to stockpile bombs? It's a mouthful, but that's what it is.
I'll say it was very fortunate of me that I actually bought bombs a long time ago and then never used them.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I saw that you wrote this on the cash flow, I was like, whew, okay, I guess I dodged a bullet on that one, buying those bombs in advance. But I can imagine that if you had not bought bombs before, and I don't even know if this area, if the town sells bombs, but I mean, they probably do because they all sell like the same area, but you'd have to warp back regardless, and that would take some time away. But just getting the jade also would require a lot of time because even before stepping in the mine, you wouldn't know how much bombs you would need. So I think there should have been at least more usage of the bombs beforehand to prepare you for this. But otherwise, just make bombs cheaper at this one town because this is like the closest area to it and that's just where they're going to get the most use.
Like, I know bombs are like a main staple of, say, The Legend of Zelda, but they're so replenishable in Zelda, or in the later ones, they have like the bomb flowers or whatever to do certain puzzles. But in this game, the bombs are quite expensive. They kind of encourage you to use them as attacks, but that's a bad, bad idea.
Those bombs cost money. I'm not going to buy more bombs, and they don't get dropped again like in Zelda or something. To Zelda's credit, well, I guess like in later Zelda especially, I mean, they are a little more... You could say this is too forgiving, but usually if a bombs are coming up in a puzzle, you'll get bombs nearby in a chest at least, or they are dropped, so it's not as big of a deal in those situations. But in this one, I think it would have been nice if bombs in the town would have been sold, at least if they are sold at all, I don't remember, but they should be sold at a cheaper price.
You probably get enough bombs in the chest to get through, but like, I forget if there's any red herring pits in here or not, but there's a couple other points in the games where you use consumables, like the, if you haven't gotten the bow, then there's a place you can't get past, but we'll get to that. The boss of the mine is Fess, the fiancé. He's a miner beast transformed to one of those hopping flies that you fight in the swamp. Nothing really to talk about there. But
other than it's really weird.
It is really weird. Maybe that's what the monsters in the world are. They're demons, but they're also people.
Yeah. Yeah, well, okay, it's only weird because I think it's the only situation where some person forms into a monster for no explainable reason. And there's, like, nothing in the lore that says, oh, like, Giza has turned humans into monsters or whatever. It's just so random. And then you actually have to strike him to turn him back.
Yeah.
Because I stood there for a while just letting him jump around. And I was like, he'll turn back eventually, right? But no, you actually have to kill the monster. Strange. The game just went to, like, a dark turn. I just murdered this girl's fiancé.
I thought I'd have to explain to his fiancé that I killed him, but... So the machine is found after Fess, and it's supposed to be color-coded for its password, but I don't remember seeing any colored indicators on it. I just kind of brute forced this. Maybe us as tires.
I don't know if this was a translation issue or, like, graphics didn't work. I don't know, because I didn't see colors either. So I also just brute forced this.
I'm playing on original hardware, and it wasn't there, so, you know. However, once we've done that, we can create the Bridge of Light to the Sectra Temple. So we line ourselves up, like a Bifrost bridge will appear, except it's only one color instead of rainbow. And we cross over to Sectra Temple. Now, Sectra Temple is largely water-based. How do you deal with the water, and what unique obstacles does it offer?
So in this temple, there are some places of water that you can traverse fine, and then some are just too deep and you die after a while.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is that you want to use the ice ring to freeze the water so you can cross them. And another thing that the temple offers is that there are fountains of water, and you can freeze the fountain spews in place, and then you can go up to a higher level or something.
It's not a super difficult dungeon in terms of execution, but I found that I was wandering for a bit in it. Like, there was something I missed and took me a while to retrace my steps and make some progress in it. But for the most part, this is probably my favorite dungeon in the game. I think it was just really nice ambiance, and I like the puzzles and using the ice in it. Magic refills
likewise,
are plenty.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was quite nice. We do fight another unique boss here. It's sort of like a water snake or a water dragon. What do you think about this boss?
I thought it looked really cool, but I think maybe I overleveled because it went down in like 2 hits.
Yeah, I mean, that's possible for sure. But it's also, it has a really weird hitbox. I think it's difficult for it to actually hit you depending on where you're standing.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
I think it shoots projectiles at you. Like, it spews water at you, but died too quick for me to really find out.
It was pretty cool, though. It was pretty cool.
It was cool.
We then meet the second set of Dragon Lords, and the Gardrak becomes the Soul Drak. We get a bit more lore, and sort of the next pin in our map is we have to go to the ruined town of Neil. So I found Neil a lot earlier than like some of the other places. I was there quite early, so I knew where it was and all that, but I couldn't do a lot there. You couldn't do anything with the well at that point. But it's a ruined town in the southeast of the map's main area. I think it might actually be Katarina's hometown.
I think so, because you find a note there or a letter she was sending back and forth to someone. I think, was there a parent? I don't actually remember.
Parent or guardian there, but your mentor was exchanging correspondence with them in regards to how she was doing. We have to get here after returning to Hujia again, so there were 2 chests at the beginning of the game in Hujia, the second town, in that first little area, that when you try to open them, they say come back when you've proven your ancestry or proven your heritage or something like that. So once you have the Soul Drak, you can open them. One is an empty vessel for the Guardian of the Forest, and another is a map to Neil. I mean, we found Neil before, but now you have a map to get there. So that's all good. So, Neil is a ruined town, but there are some people still living there, and someone has fallen down the well. There's 2 children that come out and tell you that their grandfather's fallen down as well. And you can't progress deep into this dungeon until you have the gloves to push the heavy statue off the bridge, which, you know, I think those gloves were in Sectra Temple.
Honestly, there's only been 3 instances where you need to push a statue. fall down something.
One of them was the North Cave, which I went to about 5 fucking times trying to get past that statue. And getting these gloves and realizing what they did was like, you know, chef kiss. I could go and finish that that friggin' North Cave. The dungeon isn't very long, but this is the one I think you required a bow to progress to the end.
I think you get the bow way back in Kostra or something.
Yeah.
There's a girl who says, I hid my dad's bow in this cave so he can stay home more often. Which I was just, dang girl, you walked all the way over there. But yeah, so you can get the bow from there. And then I like the option that you can talk to her dad and you can return the bow if you want. Which yeah. I thought was it was interesting. I did try to offer to return the bow to him and he says I can keep it, which was nice.
Yeah, I did as well, yeah.
Although I question, like, isn't he a hunter? How are they going to eat now? So, I don't know. I hope they're okay.
Yeah, but I guess there's demons. You know, I can give them the bow back after the demons are gone. So.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But in any case, yeah, so you got in this bow like a long time ago. I mean, you'll have to buy arrows separately. The arrows are actually relatively cheap compared to bombs, but if you wanted to use a projectile, you could use the Hausa. And honestly, I just never used it ever.
Mm-hmm.
But there will be this puzzle in the well that you can see a dragon statue on the other side of a chasm, and there are 3 arrows embedded also into the wall, so that's your clue to use the bow. Kind of difficult to actually hit the statue for some reason, but that's the only required use for the bow in the game.
Now, when we retrieve the old man, he will restore your carving into a blessing, which is a fairy. I kind of wish she did talk to you a little bit. She's just a fairy that's used in one area. But that area is important because we're going to head towards Mount Badsell now. And to get to Mount Badsell, we are going to navigate a forest. And what does the blessing do in the forest?
So the forest is kind of our lost woods here. And blessing will show you which path to go without, you know, looping around endlessly, of course.
Yeah, so when you use it, the fairy appears on screen and she shows you which way to go. So we reach the guardian goddess of the forest at the end, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She appears as a statue initially, and then she comes to life and tells you, I think, lore or something. I don't know.
There's some lore, and she also explains to you how to use level 2 and 3 magic, and she tells you that you need level 2 thunder magic to progress to the end of the game, basically.
Yeah.
So now we're going to climb Mount Badsell. What's sort of the main structure of this climb?
So a lot of this climb is that you will have the rocks that you will need to use lightning for. I don't know if you can use bombs on these, but, you know, as we just talked about previously, I don't want to waste any bombs. But yeah, you just hold down the lightning for, I think, 2 seconds. I don't actually know if you can also do it with 1 star for some of the rocks.
Yes.
To clear the path, but regardless, you can use the lightning ring for this. Mm-hmm. And it's just lots of jumping across chasms and so on. I think the encounters here, how they're placed, is probably the first time and where I actually had to use the house a lot. So after all this time, I had to switch over.
There's 2 like climbs of Mount Badsell, but in between there is a first-person section where you can get some upgrades, but you can also, most importantly, get the fire boots. And this is the area I think you have to bump into things a couple times to break open a hatch in them.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if you need to run into them or select them, but they stick out pretty obviously, and you've never seen such landmarks before, so they're suspicious, so it's not a big deal.
So those fire boots are super important. They allow you to walk on fire floors without taking damage. There's a few fiery areas like that I tried to get through, but it pushes you back when you take damage from the floor, so it was just...
Yeah.
Although I had health and potions, I could have brute forced my way through. It's just getting knocked back. This made it not a good proposition. There's a second climb. We talked about the yellow rocks. Those are the ones that the goddess tell you to use level 2 thunder on. Both thunder upgrades, by the way, are in the swamps. But that's interesting. They do require you to explore a little bit. I don't know how people might feel about that, but if you're playing this kind of game anyways, you're probably looking for all these upgrades.
I thought it was pretty funny that you get to the other side of Mount Badsell in one of the exits and you end up in the desert cave. Oh, that's funny I ended up here.
Well, that desert cave. I got the fire boots. I went down the mountain, went to the desert cave. Because I was playing this when my younger brother was around, and he was curious about it. And we were kind of frustrated because we went through the fire cave and there was nothing there. So when eventually we came back down the mountain, and that's where it led to. It's sort of this, you know, kind of a shake your head kind of moment. So I guess I didn't have to backtrack to do these fiery caves and get that fire ring and all that. So once you descend Mount Badzel, you can go to the fiery area of a cave in the desert. But there's also a different path you can take that can allow you to reach sort of a glowing door to the underworld. They're giving you the option to backtrack and get any loose ends cleared up before you head here. Are the enemies much more dangerous down here, or have you leveled beyond concern, like these Grim Reapers and such?
Are you talking about in the underworld? Sorry.
In the cave leading to the underworld and the underworld itself, yeah.
So for Mount Badzel and part of the game after this, I think I had leveled up appropriately. It was definitely a step up, especially at the end portion of this, but it wasn't as bad, I think.
I think I was level 39 at the end of the game. I don't think I breached 40. So I'm not sure exactly where you were, but if that's where you were, that's probably appropriate level.
I think I was mid-30s or something.
Mid-30s, okay.
I know exactly what level it will be, because I'll talk about it shortly, but yeah.
Sure. There's a very brief walk through the underworld. It's sort of like an overworld area, but I don't think there's anything here except Giza's palace.
Yeah, I did some exploring around. You don't even get a map, but no. Yeah, I think that's only to show that it's a endgame spooky underworld.
It's intense,
and,
but yeah.
Yeah, that's about it.
Talk about Giza's palace.
So Giza's palace, the main gimmick of this place is that there are going to be a few rooms that you'll be locked in. I think this probably has the most rooms you'll get locked in to fight enemies before you can progress as previous in the game. But the main gimmick of this game is that you'll need to traverse these floors that move and shift. And I don't know, maybe I'm just impatient, but it takes forever for the floor to settle. So I kind of guessed where I had to jump. And often you'll just completely screw that up and fall down. Yeah.
I'm not aware if the floor can actually settle, but yeah. You kind of just have to feel your way through it. Like, it's wiggly, but it's like an illusion. So I think you have to guess where the true floor is. It's a bit more natural than it seems once you kind of understand where things should be. But it's definitely disorienting. And there's a lot of, as you said, if you fall down in Giza's palace, you have to retrace your steps quite a bit because of the way that the doors lock. The enemies are stronger here, of course. The mages will usually get a couple of hits on me just because they're at the other end of the screen and they're shooting their spells. But yeah, I think it's a pretty
decent
fight.
I feel like at this point in the game, I think enemies drop a lot more hearts and recovering magic and health just happens a lot more often than it did at the beginning of the game. So I felt like it was fine getting hit a couple of times, whereas in the beginning of the game, I'd be a lot more cautious about that.
The incredible amount of health that was dropping is why I was using those techniques a lot, because you're not really at much risk. And since I had the big bag, I had 5 potions, so I was kind of ready. But, you know. We get to Giza. Talk about the fight with Giza.
Yeah, so this is where I'll tell you I know exactly what level I was, because so, yeah, I cleared Mount Badzel around maybe, yeah, mid-30s, and then since we were wrapping up the game, since I saw the gate of the underworld, I wanted to do some loose ends and try to get everything. So I really looked up a guide to just try to find the rest of this stuff. And then clearing all that, I got back to Giza's palace at probably 38. And you know, I cleared my way through it, you know, finding all those golden knights and the mages and so on. And I get to the Giza fight. And just like the ice demon, when you do fight him, I am doing absolutely no damage against him. I let myself die there, and then I had to level up to 39, and I did the whole thing all over again. And at 39, I still felt like I was doing minuscule damage. So yeah. I did it a second time, and at level 40, that's when I felt I was appropriate to fight Giza.
I think 45 is the max, but that's probably overkill. I felt like
Yeah, I noticed after 40, the EXP gain is really minuscule, so yeah. I think level 40 is kind of like the soft cap.
Probably soft cap, yeah. It's like Dark Souls with 40 dexterity.
But... Yeah, okay, Matt.
Like I said, I finished it at 39. My sword wasn't doing anything to Giza, but the houses technique was doing a lot. So maybe a little bit cheesy. I turned on my mirror and I just let loose at that Hausa. Because he
maybe
can't...
if I knew about that mirror, I would have not had to grind an extra level.
He can't really hit you when you're like swinging up the Hausa technique. So it's a little bit cheesy, but that's how I got him down. Because it didn't seem like my sword was going to do anything to him. I'm sure there's a lot more of a fair way to beat him, but that's how I did it, and I kind of mained the Hausa through the whole game anyway, so I guess it's fine.
Well, I mained the sword, so I was like, well, I have to defeat him with the sword. But otherwise, I guess we should mention that the Giza is technically two phases, but the first phase you don't do anything, that's all cutscene, and you fight him for a bit, and then the ghost of his sister shows up and says... Hey, Giza, I actually got that curse because I was trying to protect you, so everything you did was for naught. And I was like, yes, this is completely what I needed right now. And then, so phase two is when you properly fight him, as we described it being. I just kind of let loose with the, since it was endgame, this was obviously final boss material, I just, like, yeah, used up all my special technique because I didn't really care about health at that point.
This whole, this whole redemption arc that Giza's going through, I have to appreciate that Alex is like, well, you still did all these crimes and killed all these people and summoned all these demons. Because I was saying that the whole time. I was like, this mother, you know, talking to his sister, he's going to have this weepy redemption arc and still be a war criminal. He's going to get away with it. But, and he kind of does by running away and breaking the castle. But here's one thing that confuses me. Like, I'm trying not to call him Matt because I named him Matt in my file, obviously, but I think I actually called him Matt in this walkthrough as well. But, like...
Yeah, you did. His canon name is Alex, please.
His canon name is Alex. There's, like, a point in the ending where they talk about how Giza became a lich, and I'm like, what? You know? Okay, so, obviously, maybe Giza as a lich is meant to be set up for the next game
Dragon
or something.
3.
Or maybe he already was a lich, but, you know, we rescue the Prime Orb. The Prime Orb saves us from the collapsing underworld, and then we get the credits, and then we get the ending of Katarina being clueless that we want to marry her, but it was cute, I guess.
Well, before we completely wrap it up, I will say that the Giza fight was all right. It was probably, like, the best fight in the game. It is appropriate as is the final battle, even though... We both kind of choose it in our own ways, but I think it was appropriate and it looked cool, so it was fine.
You know, I like this. I like this.
And Alex gets to be king. I don't know who decided that or how that worked out. I guess because he did save the world. I mean, he's got the god drag.
How about I just be a champion? It's like, you know, how about I just be the protector of the realm or something? Why do I have to be the, well, I guess the king is the protector of the realm or defender, whatever.
No, I mean, he's destined, you know, like divine right of kings and all that, something.
Katarina's like, oh, you're going away. Oh, that's unfortunate. I'm going to miss you. Like, come on. Well, he went to the fucking underworld for you. It's like, yeah, of course.
I meant to bring this up at the very beginning, but was there a specific reason why Katarina had to be kidnapped? Or was Giza, okay, look, a random chick that I'm going to go piss off this dude and I'm going to kidnap her? Did she have a lore reason to be there? I kind of forgot because the end of the game was kind of ridiculous.
She was needed to open the gate to the underworld, but I'm not sure if that's due to her heritage or what it is.
Okay, yeah. I think this bothered me for the longest time of why Katarina was kidnapped. I thought it was it because of the necklace? Because he's going to find out very quickly that she doesn't have it anymore. But that turned out not to be the plot device for that situation.
Yep.
Anyway, what a story, what a game.
Dragon View has, as we said, the overworld sections and the interior sections. Does it mesh its two styles of gameplay together well?
I would think that it does, because it doesn't give me that sort of point-and-click feel of the way it's set up, but being able to actually do less menu commands on the overworld, I think, is just a nice touch to do something more action-related, while still having sort of the menu systems or RPGs. So I think it definitely combines those two styles well. I don't know if it really combines the exploration and the action completely well, even though it does it pretty nicely on its own terms. I think it's my complaints about the map that really just hindered me about exploration, because it's a really cool idea and there's a lot of things to do. But I feel like that part of the game needs to be maybe just polished a bit more for it to really feel more coherent with the entire Super Dragon gameplay and style.
Yeah, so I mean, the second point on this discussion is about the exploration. So would you say that the exploration itself is worthwhile to go through?
I definitely say it's worthwhile to go through. I like finding all the secrets and just the way that the game scales up with encounters, that it's definitely worthwhile to get more HP and magic. I guess for the action sections, I wish there was more to using some of your other sub-weapons. We've talked about you found the mirror very useful, but then you get stuff like, you know, you can't really use the bombs, really, except for explorations. That's where they kind of get dedicated to. And the arrows, I guess, are neat, but then you only really use it for that one puzzle. So if anything, I think that part should have been expanded upon if they were going to go in that direction to have more sub-weapons at your use. But otherwise, I think if the game is more exploration for these items, then I think that also should have just been maybe more parts where you have to use the arrow to solve more of the puzzles to get these upgrades, which are very useful.
You would improve the exploration of the interior sections by requiring you to use more of your items. Perhaps what they would need to do is to create more exploration-based items, because there's things like the scales that don't get used except for that fire cave to extinguish a few flames. Because even when you go to fiery areas later, you don't have to use these scales. So it uses up an inventory slot that we could use for something else. When Rodister talked about the scales, I thought, oh, it's going to be scale armor or something that will protect us against flames or something like that, right? But no, it's like a projectile. So I think either they'd have to make arrows or bombs a drop from enemies in order to make that something that is self-sustaining or viable, yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, I could see that being working. Like, longer, more intricate dungeons, I'd be all for.
Alternatively, they could also add a variety of enemies so that maybe using the bombs and the arrows would have actually had some more use, because then the hauza is kind of your projectile, because it's a throwing weapon, and the sword is obviously up close. But again, that would have to be balanced out with,
you need to be able to run away,
you know, the being dropped. Yeah, exactly. But I mean, I guess you could also, in theory, use the rings in battle, but I feel like they're not really utilized that well. It's really, as I got into the game, mostly you could just use your regular main weapons to deal with a lot of situations in the game.
Well, there's not like a Zelda eyeball that you can shoot with the bow, right? So if they were going to make those required or advantageous to use against certain enemies, then yes, they would have to increase the enemy type variety for sure.
There's a lot of palette swaps in this game, so.
There are, yeah, there are. How would you improve the exploration on the overworld then?
Yeah, I don't know if this was within the Super Nintendo's processing powers, but I just feel like maybe just add more landmarks would have helped, or even just a more detailed map would help a lot.
Yeah, I guess I could agree to both, or have more maps available. And landmarks would definitely improve. I guess to backtrack and talk about my feelings about all this, in terms of the exploration, I enjoyed it personally because I enjoyed getting lost in Draken. So there was a certain degree of that that came back for me, and this is a very like personal bias kind of thing. I liked exploring around, and then I would open my map to see where I was, and I'd have to remember, okay, there's a like a triangle here that I'll have to come back to. But I really liked just exploring and wandering. And while Dragon View isn't as trance-like, obviously, as Draken, there was still a bit of that aspect for me, so I gotta appreciate that it did something different. I think in terms of the styles meshing, I think they mesh well enough. There's obviously they can't have the art style be as cohesive because, again, there's no additional hardware in the cartridges to compensate for this particular viewpoint, but I appreciate that they went with it. Regardless, they could have made any other kind of overworld, or if they had a more static first-person thing instead of a free-roaming one, they could have made it a little bit more similar to the aesthetic of the interior sections. I agree that more landmarks is the biggest thing, because, and also to have the landmarks on the maps, right? That would help.
Yeah, like after you find a cave entrance, or at least after you at least find something, it should be marked on your map. I think that would be helpful a lot. I mean, I also liked exploring in this game. I just wish it was, I guess because I'm now spoiled from more modern games, I just wish it was just more obvious about, again, distance or where things are, especially in the desert, because I think there are a lot of cool secrets in the desert, but does this rock look pretty similar to the other rock kind of situation?
Yeah, I'd say things that you can interact with are obvious, but if you don't turn around, you can walk like 5 feet next to something and never see it, right?
Yeah.
How was the challenge curve in Dragon View? And I think we talked about this a little bit in the podcast already.
I think the challenge curve is pretty fine for most of the game, but once you find out that you've been underleveled, then I think the game is really punishing, especially because you can't escape battles. Mm-hmm. I remember when I first got to the ice area and the ice monster took forever to kill because I just wasn't appropriately leveled up enough. I think there just needs to be a smoother transition to that, or at least be able to escape battles with some kind of punishment, like lose all your jade, which is really suffering, but you do have the option to suffer in this game.
Yeah, you do. I think the challenge curve is decent at the beginning of the game, but I think towards the end of it, you have too many tools at your disposal. I use that Hauza technique. It's a desperation attack that uses your health to do a super-powered attack. And regardless of like if I was out of depth in terms of level, it would still do a fair amount of damage to enemies, especially once I got it to level 2. So I think I had that in my back pocket throughout the underworld section of the game, so I was never really super concerned at the end. Whereas I died a few times in the first half of the game, not really in the second half.
Yeah, I think that goes back to what I just mentioned about in Giza's Palace, where I think in endgame, enemies just seem to drop hearts and stars a lot more often than they did in the beginning of the game.
Yeah.
Or they just happen to be in more pots around that you can refill easily, and then you just feel that you can take on enemies while taking some damage at that point in the game, which kind of hampers the challenge. If there were no healing items that were dropped or just accessible, then I probably would have played more safely and grinded a little more.
Right.
So there's definitely a loss of challenge just because of how quickly you can just have that replenished.
This is sort of a problem that a lot of RPGs and action RPGs at the time face. Some games like the Mana games kind of gate this by having your upgrades to your weapons or your characters sort of gated by progress. So even though you can level up, you don't get a humongous boost until you've gotten certain orbs or certain items, right? Or the way that Chrono Cross does it is that you only gain levels after certain bosses. And it's sort of an issue that RPGs sometimes have a problem finding an elegant solution to. I think what Dragon View would have had to do is that instead of a flat rate on experience for monsters, that they needed to have maybe diminishing returns. Because when I had to level up to fight that Efri, I leveled up twice by walking to the swamp, standing to the side, and killing a slime with the Hauza. It didn't do much damage, but it did enough that in a couple minutes I killed it and gotten like 600 or 700 experience and shot up 2 or 3 levels. And then I just went to the fire cave and plowed through it, right? So I think if something is way above your tier or way below your tier, maybe that there should be diminishing returns on experience, or, you know, maybe a stronger necessity to do certain things, the bosses or something like that, make them a bit more involved. It's tough because the game, although you can spend a lot of time walking around and exploring, the game's actually not that long and when it comes to the dungeons and the critical points. So I think a lot of it depends on what you decide to do, but I think it's within our nature to explore and collect things. So you're going to gain levels doing that too. So in that respect, it kind of plays its own curve and flattens it on you. So do you have any final thoughts on Dragon View?
So I had all these nitpicks, but in the end, I actually am in favor of Dragon View. So we may have broken the curse.
Might have, yeah.
There's a lot of things I just feel really off about with Dragon View, which is why I don't think it's like I was super ecstatic about it. But I was definitely in favor of it. And I think one of the things that put me in favor of it is just that the presentation is pretty cool. Just the way it's set up, like the first-person view in the overworld and then your action being on the top half of the screen. I think it's just really neat. I haven't really seen that really done a lot in Super Nintendo games before. And the sprite work is actually pretty cool, in my opinion. I wish there were more enemies and a variety of them, just because I just want to see more of it. Like, the animations are pretty neat. I don't know, it just looks really cool. We didn't really talk about it, but I think the way that the dialogue is presented in this game is pretty neat, too. It's presented sort of like you're reading a novel.
Yeah.
Although, I don't know, something about the way that text is presented in this game kind of drives me crazy. I think it might be too large or something. I don't know, maybe I'm just so spoiled from newer games that seeing this gigantic block of text at the bottom of the screen was like a bit much for me. But the way it says, like, and then Alex looked forlornly or something, I just thought it was a neat way to present how the narrative went.
Yeah.
Which is something I also don't think I've seen before. So I think going in that direction was pretty neat. I think it could have probably needed a cleaner translation to really shine, but I still think like going in that direction just gives it more a unique look to it. I wish music was better. I don't know. Some stuff was fine, but like looking back, and I don't even remember a lot of the music in this game. So it's a lot of ups and downs, but I think for the most part, Dragon View is pretty all right. So there's stuff that I thought was pretty cool, and then stuff I was pretty irritated with, but in the end, I still overall liked it a bit.
I think you might have had a different opinion of some of that stuff had you played Dragon first. Especially like the music. Like, the music of Dragon isn't for everyone, but it's so atmospheric and somber and sort of different that, like, it's not really captured in Dragon View, and I kind of wish that it took some of those elements from Dragon here. And you're talking about enemy variety, like, some of the things that you can encounter in Dragon are absolutely friggin' wild. Walking around the nighttime in Dragon is a death sentence at early levels. I don't want to get too much into it because it's so different that it has to be seen instead of talked about if you haven't played Dragon. And I kind of wish that some of these elements were incorporated into Dragon View, because a lot of the enemy designs in Dragon View are very safe. That said, like you said, there is ups and downs in the game, but it's a pleasant game with interesting presentation, and it's a follow-up to a game that is very polarizing. Like, Dragon's very polarizing. Nowadays it is anyways. And I think it does well, and for me, I mean, that's really, really cool. I just like a game I can kind of get lost in and wander around and walk around and fight some monsters and, you know, clear some dungeons. It's a neat one. It's not my, like, on the tops of my Super Nintendo lists, but it's a very matte game when it comes down to it. I kind of just appreciate that.
There weren't even a lot of dragons to view in this game. What was up with that?
That's right. There's not a lot of dragons to view in it. They're all holograms. There's dragons in Dragon. Just saying. Maybe, like I said, maybe this will be a gateway game to Dragon at some point. My final thoughts for Dragon View is I think it's a really solid game, and one that I'll be looking forward to playing again. I don't think it's as replayable as some of the Super Nintendo action RPGs I like. It definitely does a lot of things right, and definitely does a lot of things differently, which is always something I give games credit for, and I think that if anyone listening is into like action RPGs on the SNES, it's worth giving Dragon View a spin. It's definitely really solid, and I was happy to play it again because I love Draken and everything related to it. So good stuff. I enjoyed it, and I think it holds up as a pretty stellar game. So this has been the December 2021 podcast for Dragon View, a.k.a. Super Draken. Hack, hack, Draken. We might be doing more Draken in the future. We'll see. We'll see if I can ply my influence in terms of that.
Yeah, you can wait for your birthday cast next year or something. So
yeah. Chris, where can we reach you?
You can reach me at twitter.com/Karasu, C-A-W-R-A-S-U.
And where can we reach Errol?
And you can reach our dear horse, Agro, who had a, I guess, pleasant Christmas story. Well, she always does. At twitter.com/agrocast, A-G-R-O-C-A-S-T.
And you can reach me at Matazoic on Twitter, M-A-T-T-O-Z-O-I-C. It's like the Mesozoic era, except the dinosaurs are better. You can actually see the dinosaurs, unlike dragons, that you don't really view in Dragon View. And the website's the same, madzoic.com.
How many dragons are there to view on your website?
I'm not certain. If you can find the hidden Priscilla gallery, you might see some.
I'm going to go search right now.
That's on Google Drive. Chris, what are we doing next month?
Next month, we are going to be eaten by a guru, because I have decided that we should cover one of the first interactive fiction text adventure game, Zork.
Yeah, so that'll be an interesting one to talk about. We'll see what kind of format we do it, and we'll see how we actually make playing through the game. So I haven't played it in a long, long time. I played it on... Well, we'll talk about that next month.
But until then, cheers.
Cheers. Evil and might.
Other figures available separately include Crystar, Warbow, and Feldspar. Crystal Dragon and Lava Dragon each sold separately. The Saga of Crystar Collection by Remco.
Hi, honey, I'm home.
Hi, honey, I'm home in the living room, Nikki.
Hey, very nice. The elves did a terrific job.
Tell elves I bought everything at Shoppers Drug Mart.
Mrs. S. Claus went to a store for Christmas?
Frankly, Shoppers Drug Mart had a much better selection than you.
Ho, ho, ho.
You want ho, ho? Look, tree lights, trimmings, cards, wrapping paper, and all at very low prices.
Does the world know about this?
It does now, sweet patootie.
You're gonna be happy.
Happy Christmas.
Shoppers Drug Mart.